Last session, we were focused upon the Roman trial of Jesus, which ended with Pilate declaring him to be crucified. That happened shortly before mid-morning. So the third Jewish hour of the day, the ninth Roman hour of the day. Just to shortcut it for our purposes, we'll say right around 9 a.m., so shortly before that, maybe 8:30 or so. That's when the declaration of crucifixion was issued by Pilate. And so Jesus now has to be transported or escorted from the Tower of Antonia to the place of execution. And he'll be carrying the cross piece for the execution. It's highly unlikely that he would have carried an entire cross, you know, the big piece plus the cross piece. More than likely, just the cross piece that would then be lifted up and put in place on upright stakes at the site of crucifixion. Now, where is that site? Let me touch on that real quickly here at the beginning. We know that it's referred to in this text here in just a moment as Golgotha, the place of the skull. That's Aramaic for skull. We also know it by its Latin name, Calvary, Calvaria, the place of the skull. There are two potential sites, and I like to visit both whenever I'm in Jerusalem. We're going again in October, and I look forward to introducing first-timers to both of these places. I think if you go to both, you are guaranteed to have been somewhere very near the site of Jesus at one or the other. I have a preference, and I'll explain that to you in just a moment. The first site is the site that exists underneath the complex called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's about 1,400 feet or so south-southwest from where the Tower of Antonia used to be. The complex grew up over this site because it was designated by Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine the Great, in the early 300s of the Christian era, because she was convinced through circumstances of her in visiting the city of Jerusalem that it was closest to where a piece of the true cross was located. There's quite the story that grows up around that idea. I don't want to delve into it because I don't think it's accurate, but it does help identify the reason why Helena went with this location and had the church built up over it. That site seems to have been immediately outside the walls of Jerusalem toward the west, maybe outside of a gate that was located near there, and therefore would have been a potential site for an execution place because you wanted to have it near a roadway so that people would see the execution happening, because the idea of public execution is to chill the inclinations of others that might think of engaging in similar crimes. But you had to have it outside the walls because it would be it would not be helpful to the people of the city to have executions happening inside the walls near their residences. So this site seems to have been a tomb that was carved out inside of a natural cave, and nearby was like a quarry wall or a cliff face, and I think somebody found like a little hole down at the base of that cliff and said that that was the hole in which the cross was situated. And so that's what you find when you go inside the complex of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. There's a place where you can go up on top of that cliff and look down. There's a place where you can go into a little side alcove and you can see through a window, the actual cliff face itself. I think you can even look down and see this hole that they point to as being the cross hole. And then not very far away, just a couple hundred feet, is the little shrine that's been placed over the top of where that tomb was located. And that's under a great big rotunda. So that's the site that most of the Roman Catholics and Orthodox peoples go to and accept as Orthodox, as the real place. I don't. That's not my preferred place. I go there because I think it's important to go there. The other place is located about 12 or 1,300 feet north-northwest of the Tower of Antonia site. It was popularly identified in the 1800s because someone had looked out from the top of the Damascus Gate and saw a cliff face that looked very much like a human skull. And nearby was a garden from the first century that had a tomb from the first century in it. And in this tomb, there were no bodies. It was an empty tomb. In the front of this tomb, there's a little groove where you could see that a rock could have been put and rolled into place. So everything matched really nice, and that's the one I liked the best. But the fact of the matter is that site wasn't first identified in the 1800s. When you go into the empty tomb there, the garden tomb as they call it, there is a little red cross or several little red crosses that have been painted on the wall. And that design of that cross is from, I think, the 4th, maybe the 5th century. And it's those paint marks are that old. So this site had already been identified not too long after the Church of the Holy Sepulchre had been built as an alternate place where Jesus might have been buried. And I am very much impressed by the fact that the rock face nearby looked very, very, very much like a skull. It doesn't look like that anymore. It's right at the back of a bus station now, so you have to kind of get into a viewing platform in the garden tomb area to look at it. One of the eye sockets has caved in because of erosion that has taken place over the couple of millennia. But they show you a picture from the early 1900s, I think, where it was still intact. And it looks all the world like a skull. And so I believe that's the much more likely place. We always have a time of meditation, and we even take communion right there on the grounds. There's a society that's purchased the property, and they hold it as a special place for anyone that wants to come and meditate upon the work of Jesus Christ. I really love that. So if you get a chance, come with me to Israel in October, and you'll see this for yourself. So Jesus, shortly before the mid-morning point on this 14th day of the first Jewish month, is taken by the Roman escort from the Tower of Antonia to one of these two places. So we're only talking about somewhere between 1,300 and 1,500 feet. And the tradition is that before he got very far from the Tower of Antonia, he fell under the weight of the cross. And then this happened. Let's read from Mark 15, 21. It says, "They compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene," or Cyrene. Cyrene is a place on the north coast of Africa. Has a Jewish population there, who was coming in from the country, so from the rural area into the city, because this is the day on which Passover lambs are to be slaughtered. It's the day of Passover, but it's also the day leading up to the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it's a big religious day. And so he's coming in, perhaps he's coming in for the prayer hour that starts mid-morning. And so he's coming in from the country. And then Mark throws this in, probably because these two people are known to the church of the second half of the first century, the 60s, whenever Mark is writing this down. He was the father of Alexander and Rufus. So probably these guys are well known to members of the church community, that they're the kids of the man that carried Jesus' cross. And so they compelled Simon to carry his cross. There was a Roman regulation in place that allowed Roman centurions, Roman soldiers, and Roman officials to compel any able-bodied person to carry something for them from point A to point B. And Jesus even references this regulation. He says in his Sermon on the Mount, if someone compels you to go with them 1 mile, then voluntarily go with them 2. So that's what we're seeing happen here, is they needed someone else to carry this cross piece and grabbed Simon, and they could compel him to go apparently up to 1 mile, but he only needs to go probably 1,000 feet, maybe a little over 1,000 feet. All the way to Golgotha, which is the place of the skull. Now, while they're on the way, something else happens that is mentioned in Luke only. Luke 23:36. Let's read the part about Simon first. As they led him away, they seized one, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. So now you see the organization of this execution parade, if you will. Jesus is walking in front. Simon is right behind him carrying the cross piece of the cross, and the Roman soldiers are escorting him. Verse 27, there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. So there are people crying, ladies in particular, crying over the fact that he is now being led out to be executed. But turning to them, to the ladies, Jesus said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' And then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Now, what Jesus is implicating here is the fulfillment of Daniel chapter number 9. The idea that when the Messiah arrived, he would be cut off without justification, that is, executed without reason, and that shortly thereafter, the judgment of God would fall upon the entire city, and it would be desolated. The temple would be destroyed, and the city as well, and the people in it would suffer. We've actually seen this language from Jesus elsewhere. Remember the day he came in on the donkey on the 10th day? He cried over the city, and he talked prophetically about how it would be surrounded and siege banks would be raised up against it, and not one stone would be left upon another. And then a couple of days later, when he gave the Olivet Discourse, that's also his focus. And he even said, you know, when you see the abomination of desolation, get out of town. When you see the army surrounding the city of Jerusalem, the holy city, get out of town. And he even said, woe to those who are pregnant or nursing children in those days, because these will be the days of vengeance spoken of in the prophets. So that's where he's come back to again. These ladies are crying because he is being cut off. But he wants them to understand that there is another big time of grief that is fast approaching, AD 70, basically. And they really need to be crying about that. His last words here, the parabolic words, the idea that if this is happening while there's still some life in Jerusalem, imagine what it's going to be like when all the life is gone, when the tree is dried up to the roots. John the Immerser used that imagery, talked about, you know, the axe is already being laid to the tree. Every dry branch is going to be gathered up and thrown into the fire. This is judgment talk, and it is all tied in to the follow-up to the execution of the Messiah as predicted in Daniel chapter number 9. Now, we are told, by the way, since we're right there in Luke 23:32, that there were two others who were criminals that were led away to be put to death with him. And then they arrive at the place called the Skull, where they were crucified. Him and the criminals, one on the right and one on the left. We'll come back to that in just a moment. When they first arrive at the site, Matthew chapter 27 reports that this happened. This is verse number 34. They offered him wine to drink mixed with gall, but when he tasted it, he would not drink it. Mark reports the same thing. Now, there's a lot of speculation thrown out there about that, and I'm going to engage in it as well. It seems as if this was offered as a mercy, that the soldiers, perhaps in pity to him, offered some wine to take the edge off of what was about to take place with the crucifixion. This mixing with gall, we know that the ancients added all sorts of aromatics and things to their wines, and that might have been what we're talking about here, some sort of aromatic herb referred to as gall that's been put into the wine, which they themselves had. Don't know if that's the reason why, but that is suspected to be the reason why. Later, there will be other offerings of wine that are in mockery, and we'll reference that. We also have the time right before his death that he requests something to wet his mouth, and he is given a spongeful of a really cheap sort of wine that may have come out of the canteens of one of the soldiers that was there. But this one seems to be that the moment he tasted this particular beverage, he decided not to drink any more of it. And so the suspicion that many people put out is he didn't want to take the edge off, that he wanted to feel the full effect of the crucifixion. I can't speak to that. I don't know. That would have to be something that would come from his mind, and we don't have enough evidence for that. So I'm going to leave it at that. The crucifixion itself is described in Luke 23, verse 32 is where we were just a moment ago. 33 says, and when they came to the place that was called the Skull, where they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right, one on his left, so we know Jesus was in the center. And crucifixion was intended to cause great stress upon the person who was being crucified and upon those watching it, because it was intended to be a deterrent. Crucifixion was perfected by the Romans. practiced by the Greeks before them, but can be seen in its earlier concept amongst the Persians. You may remember in the book of Esther, it talks about how Haman, that wicked man, had ordered that a, usually in our English text it says, he had ordered that a gallows be built so many feet high. Well, it's not a gallows as in a place to hang a person from a noose, but rather a tall, wooden thing that the Persians originally impaled the dead bodies of their enemies or criminals on so that they'd be way up high so that everybody could see them. But then eventually, perhaps the Persians, and then definitely the Greeks, and definitely the Romans, would start affixing people while they were still alive to these high prominences made of wood in order to cause them great pain in front of anybody else. The Romans kind of perfected it. They did the whole psychological thing. It seems as if they had the cross piece so that they would stretch the person's arms out and nail them through the wrist portion of the hand. That's still part of the hand, all the way up in the wrist. And then they would kind of bend their knees in such a way where they would nail their ankles to the bottom part of the cross. And this would allow the person to push up on those feet nails in order to get a breath in from time to time. Because crucifixion kills by causing the person to suffocate eventually, because they have their chest muscles extended by their arms being stretched out, and by the weight of their torso pulling down on their chest muscles, on their torso. And so it's all putting stress on the diaphragm area to breathe. This is why eventually when Pilate decides to hurry the crucifixions, he has his soldiers break the legs so that they can't push up on the nail anymore in order to take the pressure off of their arms and off their chest in order to get another deep breath in. So when we picture the crucifixion, you can picture them with arms outstretched, nailed through the wrists, and their knees slightly bent one side or the other, and both feet affixed with a single nail. That seems to have been the way that it was done. Then John chapter 19, I almost skipped this part. Verse 34 of Luke 23, very important. The first words of Jesus from the cross. Jesus said, immediately after being crucified by the soldiers, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." That is a reference to the soldiers. I am fully convinced of that. These men are probably young soldiers. I doubt that veterans would be given this detail. They were given this detail to go out there and just watch these guys die all day long. Make sure nobody interfered with the process. And so they're just doing their job. Two of the guys were already scheduled to be executed because they were murderers. They were probably compatriots with Barabbas, who was released during the last couple of hours. They had they'd caused trouble in the city for the government and had even killed people. And so that's what they're dying for. So these soldiers are like the equivalent to our prison guards working on death row that have to carry out an execution. They're just doing the work of the government. And so Jesus prays on their behalf. "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." You might remember that he said something similar to Pilate. He said that Pilate did not bear as much responsibility for what he was doing in all this than the Jewish people, the Jewish leadership did. It seems to have been referencing to the high priest, because Pilate did not know the full prophetic story. And so Jesus' first prayer out of his mouth when he's on the cross is on behalf of those Romans, those Gentile soldiers, young men, just doing their job, that didn't have a clue the role they were playing on this day. And I certainly hope that all of them were able to follow up in their own personal lives to become followers of Jesus. There's stories about it that they did become followers of Jesus, but we can't be sure until we end up in eternity itself. They have over them, by the way, a centurion that we will come back and talk about him before we're done with all this. We've only got about a minute left, so we may not get through the fullness of this. John chapter 19, verse 19. It says that Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. All of these criminals had their condemnation charge listed prominently above their heads to make it plain, this is what happens to people who commit this crime. So Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Not something like rebel, not something like murderer, rioter, seditionist, tax evader, nothing like that. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, Latin, and in Greek. And we'll have to come back to that next time.